Howdy, I'm Nolan Gray, your friendly neighborhood city planner, research director at California EMB, and one of the leads on the Metropolitan Abundance Project. Welcome back to the Abundance Podcast. In this episode, our policy director, Ned Reznikoff, chats with Alexander Sahn. I had to take the week off, sorry. Sahn is a Thomas J. Pearsall Fellow and an assistant professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he studies inequality in political participation, representation, and public policy, especially focusing on subnational governments in the U.S. He was previously a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics at Princeton University and received his PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. In this episode, Ned and Alex chat about public engagement, exclusionary zoning, and civil service reform. If you haven't already, please take a moment to like, subscribe, leave a review. If you're listening to this on Spotify or on YouTube, you can leave a note or a comment letting us know who you'd like to hear from next. We'd love to hear from you and continue the programming. With that, on to the show.
Yeah, Alex Sahn, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I wanted to maybe start off with like a general framing question, which is just how would you describe your research interests? I mean, like what specific part of kind of housing and urban policy are you really interested in?
Yeah, so I'm a political scientist. And so when I talk to other political scientists, what I say I study is kind of the intersection of institutions of municipal government in the US and kind of the political economy of race and representation, and like which groups kind of are better represented and get more policy outcomes that they want. And so both of those things intersect pretty directly with housing. You know, housing is a policy area that's almost entirely administered by local governments in the United States. And it's, you know, one that directly deals with where different groups of people live. And so housing policy can be used as a tool to integrate or exclude communities from different places. And so a lot of my, you know, kind of work has to do more or less with like the institutional piece versus the group and kind of race and ethnicity piece, but it kind of sits at the intersection of both.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sits at the intersection of both, because I mean, I think nowhere else more so than in the first paper that I wanted to talk to you about, which is racial diversity and exclusionary zoning. So could you just maybe kick us off by talking a little bit about some of the research that you're building on from Einstein and Glick and Traunstein and others, and what distinguishes your project with this particular paper from some of the work they'd already done?
Yeah, definitely. So the people that you just cited, Katie Einstein and her co-authors at BU, and Jessica Traunstein, who's now a political scientist at Vanderbilt, have really kind of paved the way for the study of housing politics basically over the last decade. And so it's been kind of a really exciting time to work in this area and also to see engagement from outside of academia with that work. And so Traunstein's work in particular has like done a really great job of advancing this argument that land use regulations contribute to segregation and lock people out from jurisdictions or even areas within jurisdictions that have high quality public goods. So good parks and schools and public safety and things like that. And how I would kind of summarize the contribution from the Neighborhood Defenders team is that this policy is made with the input of a very small slice of the population that happens to be very unrepresentative of residents of the city as a whole, representative or unrepresentative both along demographic lines. People tend to be whiter, wealthier. They tend to be homeowners, people who show up to public meetings in particular. And they also have different opinions about how land use policy should be structured and implemented in local governments. And they tend to be much more opposed to, in particular, the construction of new housing. And so my paper kind of starts with this observation from trans teens work, that a big driver of segregation and inequality in cities is land use policy. And, you know, if you read a lot of urban economics, they also point to these policies driving high housing costs, and a lot of kind of inefficiencies in local housing markets. And so my work tries to answer, well, if we know that these policies have all these bad outcomes, both in terms of housing costs and in terms of segregation and inequality, like, why are they on the books in cities across the United States? There's also, you know, some, you know, a lot of planning, urban planning work that shows that the United States is really an outlier compared to the rest of the world, in particular in how much it restricts the construction of multifamily housing. And so to kind of answer that question, I try to look across a bunch of different cities in the US and isolate the effect that race has on exclusionary zoning. So zoning that allows only single family homes to be built at the exclusion of multifamily homes. And so there's kind of this longstanding argument that the effects that trans student documents, that land use regulation contributes to segregation, that these effects are intentional, that they were actually put into place to achieve that goal. And so I try to test this systematically. And the way I do this is I basically look at this really critical time period in American cities, basically from 1940 to 1970, when three things are happening. So the first, which, you know, kind of directly speaks to the question I'm trying to answer, which is, does an increase in racial diversity cause cities to zone more land for single family homes? That is, does this kind of racial threat, what we call in the academic literature, people reacting to increasing diversity, does that translate into this policy that's designed to exclude people from neighborhoods? And so I turn to this period from 1940 to 1970 to basically look at how different cities changed as a result of the Great Migration. So this is the kind of largest internal migration in American history. Between 1940 and 1970 specifically, you see about 3.5 million African-Americans leave the largely rural South to go to cities largely in the North and the Midwest and a couple cities on the West Coast. And so this kind of gives a shock of increasing racial diversity in cities during this time period. And so I look at whether cities that became more racially diverse today have more exclusionary zoning. And I find that basically for every 1% increase in Black population growth between 1940 and 1970, we see cities zone about 1% less land for multifamily housing today. That is, they have these higher rates of exclusionary zoning. So there seems to be this direct link between this time period when there was this rapid increase in racial diversity, and there was also a lot of other policy change. So a lot of the legal mechanisms by which segregation was maintained were dismantled during this time. So there's a lot of court action that renders things like restrictive covenants illegal. The Fair Housing Act outlaws discrimination by landlords, you know, renting to tenants of different races, and, you know, forces sellers to not racially discriminate when they're selling their home to a new family. And so basically the argument that I advance from this is that the exclusionary zoning kind of steps in as a race blind substitute. That is, that it, you know, can stand up to court challenges that are now able to be brought because of the Fair Housing Act, but that achieves roughly the same goal of locking racial minorities out of these single family high opportunity neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think this is a really important nuance. And so I want to recap it a little bit for listeners, but what you're saying is that there's been all this scholarship about the ways in which restrictive zoning leads to segregation. And what you've identified is actually a sort of causal mechanism where demographic pressures, increasing diversity in a city seem to actually drive a response where wealthier, more affluent cities or neighborhoods begin to downzone or put in place stricter land use controls, specifically in order to keep out Black residents.
Yeah, that's correct.
So I mean, a few follow-up questions from that. I think the first one is you mentioned the way in which this sort of restrictive zoning can be used to regulate access to community benefits and resources. And I just wanted to maybe make that a little bit more concrete. So what are we talking about here? Are we talking about schools, other public amenities? What typically are these white homeowners? What have they been trying to block other people from having access to?
Yeah, so think about, the city that you live in today. Obviously, there are neighborhoods that are kind of more and less desirable. And a big part of that desirability comes from what we call public goods, which are basically things that government provides. This could be anything from like physical infrastructure. Some neighborhoods have streets that were recently paved and some have streets that are filled with potholes. This can be, amenities, things like parks. Some have trash in them and some don't. Some, have the lawn mowed and have, facilities for kids to play at, and some, just have kind of concrete. All of these things that governments provide tend to not be provided equally across neighborhoods. And so the school piece is obviously a big part of this. That overlaps, but is not kind of entirely the same as these other public goods, because often school districts are not contiguous with neighborhood or city boundaries. But generally speaking, like when you buy into a good neighborhood, you're buying into the set of things that the city government provides. And so there's kind of this perception at this time that allowing basically Black people into neighborhoods is going to reduce the quality of public goods. It will either lead to kind of crowding or like contamination, or that, the city government will become less responsive to that neighborhood because they see the need to cater to white neighborhoods. And so an integrated neighborhood might not get as much attention.
And there's also a home value and home assessment element of this too, right? Because we're talking about during the era of redlining, when essentially racially diverse neighborhoods were considered less desirable for the purposes of actually providing housing financing or for just kind of assessing home values.
Yeah. So if you talk, if I told this story to an economist, they would say, this is totally consistent with what we're saying. All of the stuff you're talking about is priced into home values. You can have a white person who is not racist at all, but knows that there are other racist people in their neighborhood. And so an increase in diversity in their neighborhood is bad for them because it's going to lower their property values through the mechanism of these other people who discriminate wanting to live there less. And so that may be a reason why they, support exclusionary zoning. Mm-hmm. So I actually show that it goes beyond just this property value story by looking at the attitudes on surveys of people during this time period. And so I actually show that there is an increase in people holding basically racially discriminatory views in cities that experience more of this demographic transition than others. And in particular, there's kind of questions on policies related to race and housing during this time period, things like support for the Open Housing Act. And I find that in kind of the cities that are both experiencing more of this Black population growth and that ultimately adopt more exclusionary zoning, that the white residents of those cities are more racially conservative. They hold views that are against, enforcing the open, enforcing open housing during this time period. So I kind of argue that the step is that, you have this demographic change, then white people in that area update their attitudes. They become kind of more racially conservative, and then they push for these policies that will protect their neighborhoods.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I mean, a ongoing theme on this podcast sometimes is discussing the extent to which the home voter process, the home voter hypothesis, is or is not accurate. And so for listeners at home who aren't familiar with it, the home voter hypothesis is just the idea that voter behavior among homeowners is driven in large part by a desire to protect or increase the value of their home. And I think there's maybe a something to that in a lot of cases, but I think one of the things that your research points toward is that that doesn't really explain the whole picture. And something that I've suspected for a long time is that when home values are invoked by homeowners in exclusionary suburbs, a lot of times that is a sort of cover or dog whistle for a deeper feeling of racial threat. That it's not actually so much about the home values, but saying that you are concerned about the value of your home if affordable housing goes up in your neighborhood is, more socially acceptable or, a better line to tell a journalist than saying, I don't want low income people in this neighborhood, or I don't want Black or Brown people in this neighborhood.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people can have lots of different motivations in their head at the same time. And certainly my story is not saying that the home voter hypothesis is wrong. It's just saying that there is this kind of added element on top. And it's really hard to figure out people's motivations for doing various things. That's a lot of what, social scientists try to do. But particularly in the like bluer parts of the country, there is kind of a language that people use to talk about housing and change in their neighborhoods. And they know that, saying things that are kind of outright racist are not going to help them advance their goals. So they kind of use the language that they think is going to appeal to other people in their community and the, kind of elected officials who represent them.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny too, because when you talk about this sort of metering of access to public resources like parks, for example, on the one hand, you can imagine a way in which access to or enjoyment of a park, you might say, is to a certain extent zero sum, because there are only so many benches in the park, there's only so much space in the park. But on the other hand, I mean, something that's sometimes striking to me about this stuff is that oftentimes by imposing restrictive zoning and thereby limiting the growth of the tax base and just the sort of economic growth in a particular area, you're actually degrading the quality of those services. I mean, are you familiar with the sort of the Heather McGee story about the swimming pool from The Sum of Us?
Yeah, I vaguely remember this.
Yeah. So the idea is, I think it was in Alabama, when she was researching this book, she encountered a swimming pool that had previously been a whites only public swimming pool, and then it had gotten desegregated. And then rather than just accommodating the fact that it was now a racially integrated pool, the white leadership of the town just filled in the pool with cement, and then no one could enjoy the pool. I might not be getting the story exactly right, but I think that was the general gist of it. And there's a little bit of an element of that to me in some of these stories about restrictive zoning, because again, if you actually permitted more density in some of these exclusionary suburbs, you would be growing the tax base, you would be making it easier to provide high quality public services to the entire community. And then, I mean, now as we kind of get past several decades past the period of time that you were talking about, a lot of these exclusionary suburbs are filled with aging households where there is no one in the immediate vicinity to actually provide elder care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all really good points. And, you know, I think the costs are real. But as the kind of swimming pool example speaks to, often people have these like really deeply held views, and they're willing to tolerate, you know, a big cost to maintain a segregated area and live as they want to. So it's, you know, it's kind of, we see it as a lose-lose, but I think, you know, a lot of the times people are making that decision pretty consciously. I did just want to mention one thing, which is that, you know, you're talking about these exclusionary suburbs. And so my paper actually is looking at central cities, so kind of the largest cities across the US. So typically we think of the story of there being, you know, these exclusionary suburbs that are almost entirely single family zoned. And that certainly is, you know, kind of the largest, you know, case of using zoning to exclude all these kind of white flight suburbs, which were created basically from whole cloth to be single family exclusive areas. But I actually find, you know, I look at 125 of the largest cities in the US, and I find that basically the median city of, like, you think of like the center of every metropolitan region, the median city in my sample, you can only build multifamily housing on 12% of all residential land. So while these suburbs may be like 0%, even our largest cities, you know, places like Chicago and Indianapolis and like these, you know, especially the newer Sunbelt cities, they just allow multifamily housing to be built on kind of like a shockingly low percentage of land. And it's this, you know, large international outlier. And it's nice to be able to kind of put some data to that.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. You're right. I was kind of conflating the two. And I think that's an important nuance, because you're also looking at patterns from the Great Migration. And with the Great Migration was not a migration primarily to suburbs. It was a migration to those cities. And I think, you know, while at California YIMBY and the Metropolitan Abundance Project, we love to beat up on exclusionary suburbs a lot. It's also the case that cities such as Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, you know, they have their own profound and, you know, oftentimes persisting to this day traditions of segregation.
I was just going to say, and circling back to, you know, kind of the homeowner story, if you have high degrees of exclusionary zoning, even in these cities, which are like majority renter, clearly it can't just be like this, you know, small cabal of homeowners who are explaining everything. I think there's something else going on.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Fair Housing Act and just the way in which, because these sorts of exclusionary zoning rules are not explicitly race-based, that they provide a nice kind of end run around certain civil rights laws. I wanted to ask you, I mean, do you see in this research any possibility of actually being able to challenge that presumption in court? I mean, if you're actually demonstrating a causal link here, is that something that could eventually be used to challenge restrictive zoning under fair housing laws?
So I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar, so I don't know what the kind of standard of evidence would be there. But, you know, certainly I think we typically think about there being like intent versus effects, and the effects are pretty clear. And, you know, the intent, both looking at kind of the statistical analysis that I do in my work, but also just, you know, there's a lot of fabulous individual case studies kind of tracing out the process I show across hundreds of cities, but just, you know, in one specific area. So kind of Amy Dane's work on the adoption of exclusionary zoning in Boston suburbs comes to mind, you know, the stories in Color of the Law by Richard Rothstein. You know, there's just many accounts that point to this being the intent of policymakers at the time. You know, I think those two pieces to me are pretty clear, but I definitely couldn't speak to how a court of law would evaluate that.
Okay, that's very judicious of you. I mean, you know, we're both UC Berkeley alumni, and something I was thinking about reading this paper is, you know, there's the ability to demonstrate this at a high level of statistical significance as a recurrent pattern across the entire country, but then sometimes you just read specific examples of what was actually being printed in the local press in the city of Berkeley, for example, when they were inventing or I don't know whether it was them or New York first, but you know, possibly inventing single family zoning. And I mean, they were not hiding their intent. I mean, they were pretty explicit about like, yeah, we want to keep out Black and Chinese households. So I mean, it's, yeah, as you said, I mean, the evidence now is pretty overwhelming, but I mean, your paper is a great contribution to that evidence, I think, because it looks at it in a quantitative way and also kind of establishes a clear causal link there.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, the kind of individual histories are really fascinating, and you know, they're really helpful to kind of illustrate what was actually happening. Another good example that I think I talked about in the paper is in the South, also in kind of the same time period when zoning is first coming online in like the 1910s and 1920s, a number of cities have explicitly racial zoning. So they have Black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods. And pretty quickly, this is struck down by the Supreme Court. They say you can't do this. And so literally they just keep the same zones and they change the white neighborhoods to R1 and they change the Black neighborhoods to R2. And so there's really kind of no attempt to even hide what they're doing.
Oh, that's amazing. That's incredible. Well, wanted to move on to another paper of yours. I was pretty fortunate to get a sneak peek at this one, but I understand it's on its way to publication now. So coming to an academic journal near you. And this is about the relationship between public comment on during you know, housing permitting processes at the planning commission or the city council and you know, public policy outcomes. And so could you tell me again just a little bit about the sort of background for this one? And you know, we mentioned Katie Einstein and her co-authors earlier, but just some of the work you're building on here and what you were trying to establish with this paper.
Yeah. So you know, as I mentioned earlier, like the Einstein Palmer Glick book does this really great job of showing like who shows up for these meetings and how they're distinctive. So in their case, they're looking at city council meetings in the greater Boston area. And there's some other kind of work that echoes this. There's a paper by Jesse Yoder who looks at this in Houston and Palo Alto. And we just see these kind of patterns that the people who show up are demographically super unrepresentative on along racial lines. They tend to be much more white than the population as a whole. Along age lines, they tend to be a lot older. This is, you know, often because these city council or planning commission meetings are in the middle of the day or at dinner time on a weekday. And so, you know, people who have jobs or families to take care of just can't come. They also tend to be unrepresentative along, you know, how they think about their neighborhoods and how cities should change. So in the Neighborhood Defenders book, they kind of compare comments on affordable housing on 40B developments in Massachusetts, I think it is, and look at like a recent referendum in each town. And they show that, you know, support for these referenda are way above the comments. And so this kind of paints this really grim picture where we have potentially these people who are really out of step with the larger community weighing in on this process. And so what I try to do is like take the next step here and say, well, okay, so clearly they're weighing in and clearly there's this problem that they're very unrepresentative, but are they actually influencing policy? Is it the case that what they say matters for outcomes, or is it just kind of an exercise in allowing these people to vent and to, you know, spend their 3 minutes talking to city councilor or planning commissioner who's going to just vote the way that they were going to vote anyways? And so I basically try to answer that question. Like, is there a relationship between the comments that people give and the likelihood of a policy or a proposal being enacted?
And what do you find?
So I find basically that there is a pretty strong relationship between the not only kind of number of comments, but also whether people are in support or opposed, and whether or not something gets through. So what I'm looking at in this case is kind of discretionary approvals in the city of San Francisco. So I collect about two decades of data. And so as you are undoubtedly familiar with, and probably a lot of listeners, there's this kind of Byzantine approval process for a lot of development in San Francisco that allows the public to weigh in at many stages in the process. And so I kind of zoom in on one stage of this, which is the Planning Commission will have a hearing for something like a conditional use authorization or a variance. These are kind of just like discretionary entitlements that a developer will need to get if they want to, you know, kind of deviate from the zoning in that lot. And so the public can weigh in and speak either in favor or against. And so I basically go through like the meeting minutes from all these public meetings, and I am able to extract the names of everyone who comments and look at whether or not they were in support or opposed to the policy. And then I basically kind of tally up the comments in support, the comments opposed, and I look at the relationship between that and whether or not the Planning Commission votes for granting the entitlement.
For listeners at home who aren't familiar, whether it's because they don't live in the Bay Area or they're just not paying super close attention to these things, the Schoolhouse Rock version of the permitting process in San Francisco is that you go to the Planning Commission, and then you either get an approval or a non-approval from the Planning Commission, and then it goes to CEQA litigation, and then eventually the state legislature passes a law to try and get your specific project approved. But it all kind of starts at the Planning Commission. And I mean, something that I really found pretty striking in your paper is that the positive public comments, the public comments that say, yes, we want this project, actually seem to be weighted less than the public comments opposing a project. And so can you talk about a little bit about that finding?
Yeah. So, I think the takeaway that I would draw from this paper is that there is kind of that the appointed officials on the Planning Commission are listening to the people. And so there is kind of this relationship between comments in favor and comments and the likelihood of getting passed. And then there's also this relationship between comments opposed and the likelihood that something gets delayed or blocked entirely. And so it's a little hard to say with certainty that like one set of comments matters more than the other. I think a couple ways of thinking about this is one is that, you know, comments that are kind of more novel might be of more interest to these planning commissioners. If you have the same people showing up every week, like you already know what they're going to say. Now, one strategy might be to satisfy them because you know they're going to come back. But if you do have someone who's coming for the first time, you might kind of weight their comments more or less. I think, you know, one thing that I'm interested in pursuing in kind of future work is trying to figure out the process that goes on the heads of these public officials who are listening to this public comment. Whose comments do they weight more or less? What considerations do they give to it? And do they, you know, just try to be risk averse and respond most to the comments that are opposed, or do they kind of weight the comments in favor and against equally?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, maybe some of it comes down to just the actual outcome one way or the other and sort of the tail risk on either end. So, I mean, on the one hand, traditionally. I mean, I think maybe this is changing as YIMBYism becomes more popular nationwide. But I mean, traditionally, the NIMBYs, the home voters, are the ones who really turn out to vote. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also a difference between not getting a specific project built, in which case you still have a lot, or maybe a single family household that's not going to be replaced with a larger building or whatever it is. But it in that case, the parcel pretty closely resembles what it was before this whole process began. But if you actually approve the project over people's objections, then especially if they live in the immediate vicinity of it, then it's like every day they will have this very large, difficult to ignore visual reminder of the time that you went against their wishes. And so I kind of wonder if that's part of the calculation here, that it's just it's not just who is more politically powerful, but also who, if you cross them, they're going to be angrier. They're going to be more aggrieved about it.
Yeah. So there's kind of like two things there that I think are really interesting. So like one is like, who are the people who are going to make life hard for elected officials? We know that turnout in local elections is really low. People don't tend to know a lot about the candidates. And so, if you have like someone who's the head of a neighborhood organization, who is someone who's trusted in a community and can sway a couple hundred votes, like that person could be really consequential. And so, kind of figuring out who elected and appointed officials are responding to, we kind of think of like public opinion as being like this mass of people, but when you get down into local politics, individuals and kind of pivotal people can matter a lot. The second thing is like, do people like follow through on their threats? Do they, if they say, if you build this, I'm going to vote against you in the next election. We don't really know that. If a building is built and it's this like reminder of something that a politician did that they don't like, maybe that spurs them to vote against them in the next election. Maybe they forget about it entirely. Maybe they see the building go up and it has a nice new coffee shop and they are like, oh, actually this was kind of a good thing for my neighborhood.
That's a good point actually, because there's polling data I think on this that suggests that people are much they're much more likely to overestimate how unhappy they're going to be after a neighborhood change like that than they are to underestimate it.
Yeah, there's this whole set of findings in psychology that like people really tend to overestimate like how bad things are going to be, and then once they actually happen, then they kind of adapt. That's like a pretty universal mechanism. But I think in terms of like politics, we think about it. We call this thing like retrospective voting. Can voters look back on the term of the incumbent politician and evaluate them and decide whether to keep them or get rid of them based on their performance? And so when we talk about that, it's usually in the context of like national politics and like people broadly just judging like how the economy is doing. And so we know there's like voters are bad at even kind of judging like whether or not unemployment is up or down or the stock market's up or down. And so it seems like a big ask to want them to remember a vote that someone took on a development 3 years ago and evaluate whether or not it was built and whether or not the effects were good or bad as they intended. It may not be the case that everyone has to make that evaluation. It could just be that these like people who show up at the public meetings who are hyper engaged and really care about this, they can do that evaluation and kind of spread their recommendation to the rest of the neighborhood. But to me, it's kind of an open question whether or not politicians really need to worry about this at all.
Yeah. I mean, another angle of this that I think is interesting, and I'm curious how it shows up in your methodology, is there are so many different ways to kill a project from the perspective of a local approvals body. I mean, there are so many more ways to kill it than there are to actually entitle it. And I mean, I'm just curious whether that's sort of how that's reflected in the data you were looking at, because, you know, you can imagine a situation, and this happens all the time in San Francisco in particular, where you'll have a project that is opposed by a lot of local NIMBYs, and the the planning commission or a particular supervisor, rather than just outright denying the project, will say, well, we have some concerns about the design of it, the visual facade. We need more inclusionary units in here. Is there going to be sufficient parking? Like all these different questions that ultimately cause a developer to back out because it's just too expensive to keep moving forward with the project.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, there's, you know, kind of a million different ways to stop something, but only one path to get it built. And, you know, that's just kind of how the institutions are set up. The presumption is that nothing is going to change. And to make a change happen, you have to, you know, kind of get all these approvals. And so I think, like, in the data that I'm looking at, you know, San Francisco is obviously kind of a weird case. One, the politics of development are very salient, and there's a ton of really concerned people. And so there's also, you know, kind of it's a large city with, you know, kind of a lot of large development projects. And so there's large firms that have a track record of doing business in the city, and there's consultants who are paid to, you know, advise basically on how best to navigate the political process. And so, you know, you kind of have to be pretty uninformed to propose something that doesn't have a path to getting built. So what I'm looking at is like the public process at the very end of the line, but there's probably a ton of stuff going on before these projects are even proposed, where developers are, you know, trying to figure out what is feasible. They're probably talking to members of neighborhood groups and kind of people who could be potential opponents ahead of time, and trying to proactively address their concerns. And so that whole kind of behind the scenes engagement can't really characterize systematically, but, you know, it's probably where a lot of the action happens. So what happens in my data is actually that things aren't as controversial as you may expect. If, like, you read about the, you know, couple projects that are like tied up in dozens of planning commission hearings and end up never getting built. And it's also not the case that, like, most things get delayed a little bit, but ultimately get built. It's less a case of like these planning commissions blocking things outright, and it's more them slowing things down, getting changes that either reduce the scope of the project or bring some kind of benefit that a community member or someone who represents that area is asking for. But I think that's also just kind of reflecting the strategic behavior of developers and of property owners to begin with. They know that this is a really tough political process to navigate, and so they don't enter it lightly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, just a note on the process here describing, because this is a particular hobby horse of mine. The fact that the way to get things built in a city like San Francisco is to do all of that pre-work that you're describing, working with local elected officials, working with local power brokers, and trying to figure out what will get them to approve your project, that's just such an obvious breeding ground for graft. Like, of course you're going to end up with a corrupt approvals process if that sort of exercising political influence is the precondition for getting things built. I think there's this idea that of the the massive corrupt developer that we need to fight against by in part having more discretionary processes, by putting more breaks and hurdles into the approval process. But it's like, no, those are the only developers who can navigate the system that we've created. We're keeping out the people who can only operate under a transparent, unambiguous, clear set of rules.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, this is not unique to San Francisco. This happens in cities and jurisdictions all over the country. And, you know, this even happens at the federal government. You know, there's notice and comment processes for all federal rules where the public is supposed to be able to weigh in on some arcane financial or agricultural regulation. And, you know, there's a lot of great research and political science showing basically like the people who actually do comment on these things are, you know, kind of the large corporations who are being regulated because they have the resources, they have expertise. And so, you know, obviously whether or not an apartment should be built in my block, like that's a little easier for ordinary people to access. But I think the larger point that these processes that require a lot of time, a lot of expertise, they are by definition going to kind of enable the people who have the most resources to get their preferred policies. And that's kind of, you know, goes back to the neighborhood defender story. The people who show up are the people who are influencing policy.
So let's talk a little bit about your research on civil service reform, because this is a topic of, I think, significant and growing interest to people who are generally YIMBY aligned or abundance aligned, you know, talking about this question of state capacity. And you've been doing some interesting research in this area just on the sort of structure and quality of civil services at different points in history. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have a piece that is co-authored with Nick Kuipers, who's a professor at the National University of Singapore. Basically we look at this kind of stylized fact in American history, which is that you have cities at the turn basically of the 20th century are super corrupt and machine dominated, and that jobs are traded for votes. So you have, you know, people in kind of poor urban neighborhoods, particularly, you know, European immigrants, who are given jobs by the political machine, you know, usually kind of blue collar manual labor jobs. And in return, the neighborhood votes to maintain the power of the machine, despite corruption and all these kind of other bad things. And so you have these progressive era, like capital P progressive era reformers who come along, and they propose all these sets of reforms to both municipal politics, but also later kind of state and national politics. And a really central one of these reforms is to standardize recruitment in civil service. So basically to create a set of standards by which people are hired, to make sure that jobs are advertised in like local newspapers, to have a written exam, and to also control how people are fired from their jobs. So, you know, kind of one echo that's coming up now in national politics is there was a proposal kind of late in the last Trump administration, and one that is proposed if he wins re-election next year, to reclassify a bunch of federal employees who are protected by these civil service laws to a political appointee status, which allows them to be basically fired en masse for no reason. The reason that we tried to insulate bureaucrats is to make sure that politicians can't kind of put their thumb on them and ask them to do something that is of political benefit to them, but not really of social benefit to people. And so the idea behind all these reforms was to increase the quality of service delivery in cities. But one kind of other strain was that a lot of these reformers are kind of like WASPy Protestant good government types. Now this is going back to the progressive era. And if you kind of read some of the writing of these reformers at the time, it seems like another motivation was to basically get Irish and Italian and, you know, kind of European immigrants out of politics and out of government jobs. They saw them as kind of naturally corrupt. and incapable of steering government in a responsible way. And so this is something that kind of pops up in a lot of urban histories during this time period. And we basically try to investigate whether the story is true using some big data from the US Census. And what we find is that this story may have been true in like Boston and New York and some of these cities that had large immigrant populations and that had really strong machines. But we actually find that if you look at all the cities across the US at this time, that immigrants were actually discriminated against in government hiring and jobs. This makes sense. They were also discriminated against in the private labor market during this time. And that kind of standardizing the recruitment procedures actually benefited immigrants, that they increased their share of white-collar, blue-collar government jobs following these reforms, and that some of the kind of this discriminatory hiring decreased as a result. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Looking at the civil service in the present day, I mean, I used to work in Sacramento in state government, and something that I've just been continually really struck by is just the diversity of the civil service. I mean, it really has been this incredible lever for creating stable white collar jobs for people who have been traditionally excluded from stable, high prestige white collar jobs up until the present day. And so, I mean, intuitively that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm curious though, like, I mean, so you mentioned that the story is a little bit different in cities with really powerful machines. So like Tammany Hall. When you say the story is different, do you mean that in that city, the share of Irish immigrants in civil service jobs did in fact decline?
I believe so. The specific like piece of the paper I'm referring to here is we kind of break up cities into like size quintiles. So basically, we're looking at the like top 20% largest cities in the U.S. and the effects there are basically smaller and indistinguishable from zero. So basically, we don't see a change in the share of jobs held by of government jobs held by immigrants. Mm-hmm. But basically, in all the other quintiles of cities, so the 0 to 80th percentile, we do see that they in fact benefit. So what the kind of results tells us is that the story that you read about in a lot of history books may be true, but there's certainly not a lot of strong evidence for it in the largest cities, and it appears to actually be the opposite in the smaller cities. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about quality of service delivery? I mean, is that something you looked at, or that you have thoughts about how that might have changed after civil service reform?
Yeah. So in our paper, we actually don't look at service delivery as an outcome, but there is a new paper by three political scientists, Dan Thompson, Julia Payson, and Maria Carreri, where they kind of look at not specifically the civil service reforms, but some of these other progressive era reforms. And they look at a bunch of different outcomes. I don't want to misstate this off the top of my head, but I believe that they actually don't find really big differences in service delivery outcomes as a result of kind of adopting a lot of these progressive era reforms. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I feel like so much of the progressive era is still kind of up for debate what exactly happened in a really interesting way. It's something we talked about when we had Francis Fukuyama on the show, your fellow member of the Academic Advisory Council for MAP, has also written some books. He was talking about the progressive era as, in some ways, I think a sort of cautionary tale where you create a bunch of new institutions or reform a bunch of institutions to deal with the problems that are confronting you in that moment. And then those institutions persist past the period when circumstances have changed significantly, and all of a sudden the reforms that you implemented are kludgy enough that a new generation has to reform those and take things in a new direction. And I feel like sometimes we're in a little bit of that phase with certain progressive era reforms. I don't think that the idea of having a non-political civil service in general should be up for debate. Like Schedule F, which is the sort of Trump White House proposal that you mentioned to essentially politicize the civil service. For the record, I don't think that's a great idea, but there is this challenge with certain elements of the modern civil service that the progressive era functionally created that I think we're now really grappling with. So, I mean, the one that comes to mind in a place like San Francisco, or I think this is also the case in New York, is you've created these systems where you have civil service exams that are incredibly difficult, and I think keep out a lot of really high quality candidates. It's impossible to hire people, and it's impossible to fire people in a lot of civil services. So I mean, this is a little bit beyond the scope of the paper, but I'm curious how you think about that, the way in which some of these institutions, how we grapple with what prior generations have created.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really wise point. And you know, I think it has some echoes to like the public participation requirements that we were talking about with regards to public meetings, where you have these policies that were, you know, intended to achieve one thing, but kind of create this really high bar. And so they kind of lock out a lot of the beneficiaries or the intended beneficiaries of the policy. So, you know, with kind of civil service jobs, you know, as it kind of becomes more and more onerous to apply for and get government jobs, maybe you have some people who kind of select out of that market. Or with, you know, public participation, if you have a program that's designed to surface underrepresented voices, but you know, make it really the meetings at an inconvenient time and the substance of what people are supposed to comment on really arcane, you're going to get, you know, kind of people who are already empowered being the only people who show up. So yeah, I think it's a challenge that policies often have unintended consequences, and they can often be really hard to repeal once they're put into place. So, you know, in social scientists, we call this like path dependence. Once you're kind of like on a track, it's hard to veer off it. And institutions and policies are really durable. So it's really hard to get something put into place in the first place, but once it's there, it's really hard to remove. I think, you know, these kind of municipal progressive era reforms are a great example of that, where, you know, there was this huge flurry of reform in the 1910s and 20s and 30s. And since then, we've kind of just been like tinkering around the edges and have kept a lot of these, frankly, pretty weird reforms. You know, this kind of mix of like very democratic things like, you know, the initiative and the recall, and then also like super anti-democratic things like, you know, moving elections off cycle and moving, you know, powers out of the hands of elected officials and into like appointed city managers and things like that. And they make sense, yeah, as you said, in the context of like trying to solve this problem of machine domination and corruption, but, you know, perhaps less so in the 21st century when we're facing a different set of challenges.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I think, one of these unintended consequences that I think we're wrestling with now as a movement is, well, what actually replaced the traditional party machines, right? There's this really fascinating book by James Q. Wilson from like the 60s or so that it's called The Amateur Democrat, and it's about the transition for some machine-dominated cities and some not machine dominated cities to having the Democratic Party controlled by essentially upper middle class, white collar professional volunteers with very little pecuniary stake in the positions that the Democratic Party takes, but like a strong ideological stake. And, you know, you could say in some ways, like, okay, this is like clearly a good outcome that here now we have the party under the control of, you know, people who make up the sort of ideological base of the party, kind of pursuing non-self-interested ends. But there's also some danger with that, right? Because you've kind of removed some of the ability to do actual politics, because there's not much horse trading that can be done in that kind of situation. And the people who control the party are in some ways less representative of the base of the party than the machines were, because, you know, the machines were, you know, in some sense responsive to working class immigrants. And now we're talking about doctors and lawyers and psychologists and whomever who are volunteering their free time for this and might have ideas about what would benefit low-income communities in their cities, but don't actually necessarily have like a meaningful connection to those communities.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's something that definitely echoes in politics today. And, you know, there's always kind of debates over whether the Democratic Party is being pulled in one direction or another by activists who don't have the interests of the base at heart. But, you know, I do think going back to the cities, what happens kind of in the absence of parties is that there's really an organizational problem, not only for horse trading, but also for kind of picking good candidates to run, for centralizing a policy platform. And one thing, you know, that has been interesting for me to observe as a political scientist is that for a while, it was kind of unclear what the main cleavage of local politics was. In the absence of a big Democratic-Republican split, you know, most large cities in the US are pretty Democratic. There are some, you know, kind of factional fights within the Democratic Party, but really, I think over the last decade or so, the issue of housing and development and growth has emerged as kind of the main cleavage. That's the thing that people fight over. And so you have kind of pseudo parties that form around this issue and that, you know, make the stakes to voters clearer than they have been in a long time. And so I think it's kind of an interesting development. I don't know to what degree it will become like institutionalized, you know, whether there will actually be formal parties that coalesce around this, but, you know, there's kind of this constellation of interest groups that, at least to inform voters, kind of signal to them, you know, which team they should pick.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's pretty interesting. And I mean, obviously the YIMBY movement is very much part of that new constellation of informal parties. I think you're touching on something that sometimes gives me quite a bit of heartburn, which is the fear that the way this gets formalized into the party system is that YIMBYism gets polarized and gets owned by one of the two major parties. And then in that case, all of a sudden you've essentially cut the areas where you can make meaningful progress on these issues in half in that case, right? Whichever party comes to own it. And I think you could make a credible argument maybe for either one trying to embrace at least certain parts of the upzoning agenda. But yeah, I mean, if that happens, then I think the movement is probably going to go a lot further in some places, but then be in real trouble in other places.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a question I'm really interested in, and I'm doing some kind of work on this right now. But, you know, I think the broader kind of growth of the YIMBY movement has been to move away from large ultra-democratic cities into other parts of the country. And I think that is just a response to the fact that the housing crisis has spread beyond you know, expensive coastal cities. You know, where I've kind of looked at this is at the state level, where you do see the politics of it playing out very differently depending on the, you know, ideology of the state and who controls the state legislatures. And so if you kind of look at votes on housing reform bills in blue states like California and Washington and Massachusetts, ideology is super predictive of how legislators vote. The more liberal legislators vote for more housing reform bills, and the more conservative legislators vote for less. But that same relationship is totally flipped in states like Arizona or Montana, where there's a Republican-controlled state legislature. And so, you know, the content of these policies is slightly different, but not that different. And so, you know, it's really interesting to see how that has kind of evolved on two separate tracks. And, you know, there's not many issues in American politics that aren't polarized. And so I don't know if it's inevitable that it will sort into one party or another, but it's definitely something that I'm watching and very interested in.
Yeah, I'm watching it too. I mean, I would, in a way, it's interesting because it also kind of, there's an element of it that seems almost kind of old-timey, like in the way that you had, you know, during the 60s or into the 70s, liberal Republicans and liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans and conservative Democrats. I don't know if I would describe the particular, I mean, there are certain elements of the whole kind of abundance package that you might be able to characterize as more liberal or conservative. But in general, I think the analogy I'm trying to draw is just, yeah, you have this sort of coalitional politics that is happening outside of the parties in a way that you haven't really seen since, I don't know, when was the last time in American politics when that was even remotely plausible? Like by the 90s, it probably was basically dead, at least by the Gingrich Revolution.
Yeah, so like the kind of party system, like the New Deal party system, as we call it, mm-hmm. you know, basically had four parties that were forced to come into coalitions and become two parties because of the structure of American electoral institutions. It's just impossible, or not impossible, but it is throwing away votes to have a third party. And so you did have kind of these four different groups that had very, very distinct concerns, but that, you know, were able to kind of horse trade. And that was, you know, kind of reflected in both office holders and party institutions, but also in the public. And a lot of that has just really kind of flattened to the point where your, you know, preferences on taxes and abortion and the environment and all these issues are all super predictive of one another in a way that they weren't necessarily, you know, 30 or 50 or 60 years ago. You know, we're always kind of on the lookout for emerging issues that could kind of split open the party coalition, and like, you know, immigration and trade may have been those issues when, you know, kind of Trump exploited them, but it's still kind of early to tell whether or not there's a realignment going on where people are kind of going to be shifting from one party to another.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, housing might not be as good a candidate for that because, well, I always try to push back against the idea that it's not a federal issue, because I actually think the federal government could be doing a lot more to encourage the end of exclusionary zoning nationwide. I mean, it is true that most of the policy action and most of what's politically feasible in terms of policy action happens at the state and local level. And so maybe in that way, it is, it's not, in that way, it's a little bit harder to, you're not necessarily going to be, like, if you have a strong viewpoint of one kind or another on gun control, which is a federal issue or much more of a federal issue, it's not going to be as predictive of where you fall on this more state or local issue.
Yeah, no, I think a large part of that is most people probably just don't have super calcified opinions on, you know, zoning policy. It's just not something they've heard a lot about on the news or, you know, from hearing politicians talk about it. But the kind of federalism point that you brought up, like the relationship between these different levels of government, I think is super interesting as it pertains to housing. You know, as you said, like it's not a federal issue. The federal government is, you know, could make it an issue if it wanted to. There's many ways for the federal government to coerce states to do things it wants it to do. This happens all the time. But the kind of state versus local battle is one that I think is really interesting and really active. I mean, local governments have no, you know, real powers of their own. Everything's delegated to them by the states. And so the state can step in and preempt a lot of local zoning policies. And it's, you know, a political choice to either do that or not, and to what degree. And so kind of the state level action over the last couple of years, I think, reflects the frustration and the inability to get stuff done at the local level for a bunch of different sets of reasons, but probably chief among them is that, you know, when you're operating at the local level, kind of the NIMBYism problem is more acute, that as you kind of have these smaller units, any person who's impacted by a given thing is kind of going to be more, a larger share of the voter population. And when you kind of go up to the state level, you know, it's maybe less of a concern, the impacts of that one particular, project. And so, yeah, it's been interesting to see kind of the interest group strategy shift towards the states, and for state legislators to, I think, hear from their voters that, wow, like this is like a big issue for a lot of people, housing affordability, and that they feel like it's something they need to step in and take action on, to the vociferous opposition of like leagues of cities and individual cities and lobbying groups who really don't want that local control taken away.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Yeah, good question. So I kind of have a couple sets of projects that relate to like housing and local governance. So one is kind of something I was talking about when we were discussing my public meetings paper, which is to kind of see if the conditions for like retrospective voting, this idea that voters can a couple of years down the line hold politicians accountable for a position they took, you know, approving or not approving a project. So we're going to try to kind of follow some of the people who spoke at public meetings and recontact them later on and see, you know, if they remember what they thought about a project, whether they noticed if it's been built, and what their kind of opinions are down the line. Another set of projects is kind of trying to think about ways to structure community engagement in a more constructive and productive way. So I think in a lot of public processes, like just doing community engagement is like seen as a normative good. But I think we could also be thinking about like what outcomes we want to get from that, whether those are outcomes on like if we're you know, engaging the public on a rezoning proposal, if we want to have some goals on what that rezoning proposal should accomplish, what strategies are most effective to getting towards that, and then also what types of community engagement makes people feel empowered, what increases mm-hmm. trust in government, feelings of efficacy. You know, I think it's important to, if we're going to spend a lot of time engaging the public on a lot of issues, to have an idea of like what we want to get out of it instead of just checking a box to say that we had 8 sessions of community engagement. And then kind of the last project I'm currently working on is thinking about how neighborhoods are represented in city government. So when we were talking about the progressive era, like one of the benefits of machine politics was you had this really close relationship between neighborhoods and the people who were making decisions. And a lot of that geographic representation, the specific concerns of specific geographic areas is kind of left out of cities when they switch to smaller city councils, so fewer districts, and also moving from having like individual wards. So having one city councilor represent one geographic area to at-large representatives who are supposed to represent the city as a whole. And so one shift that I document is that a bunch of cities have developed these kind of advisory neighborhood level institutions where neighborhoods are allowed to weigh in on certain issues. And so I'm kind of interested in, you know, whether those advisory positions are actually taken into account, what effects they have on policy, what types of issues these neighborhood governments are weighing in on, and trying to think about this kind of like sub-city level of representation, which I think often kind of gets left out in the way that we traditionally think of federalism, which is just like state, you know, federal and local.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. There's also a lot of different examples of, I think, pretty convoluted neighborhood governance structures. I mean, I used to live in Washington, D.C., and mm-hmm. I never fully wrapped my head around exactly what was going on with the ANC system, except for finally learning that it was not, in fact, the African National Congress. It wasn't Nelson Mandela's party. It was like a specific neighborhood body. But I mean, that's something that I've always been meaning to learn more about and find kind of fascinating, that sort of hyper-local democracy.
Yeah. Yeah. So the ANCs in DC are a great example. There's neighborhood councils in Los Angeles, there's community boards in New York. And they're all set up like a little bit differently. But my hunch is that they all kind of, because they have this geographic focus, you know, are dealing with some of the issues that, you know, we talk about when we talk about space, you know, things around housing, development, public goods like parks and roads and streets and parking. And so, you know, these are all issues that a small number of people may have really strong feelings about. And my hunch is that this is another institution by which they're able to kind of nudge the dial in their preferred direction. Mm-hmm.
I had a question about the second project that you mentioned. So thinking about a different way to do community input, what's your sort of approach there?
Yeah, so I think there's kind of like two sets of interventions that I'm interested in looking at. The first is kind of setting explicit goals and having people work towards them rather than like leaving things really open-ended. So this kind of dovetails with a lot of like state level efforts, like the regional housing needs allocation in California or the like MBTA communities in Massachusetts, where targets are given to like a city. You know, you need to plan for X number of new housing units. And then the community discussion is like, how are we going to do that? It's a mm-hmm. distributive question rather than like, should we do this or not? Which is typically how like a lot of participatory processes are structured, like the public meetings I study at the Planning Commission in San Francisco. It's like, should this project get its, you know, conditional use authorization? Mm-hmm. And people are either saying yes or no. So shifting the focus from kind of an up and down vote to this thing is happening and like, how would you like to see it happen? And then the second piece is kind of on the role that like facilitators and experts can play in this process. So, you know, we have a lot of planners and cities and counties and other jurisdictions which facilitate these outreach programs. You know, what role do they play in both guiding how people come to decisions? You know, what does their presence do to the kind of dynamics of groups? There's a lot of interesting kind of research on deliberation and group dynamics that I think would be interesting to kind of pair with this specific focus on like, how can we increase community engagement to, you know, advance towards goals of like the abundance agenda, like permitting more green energy infrastructure or allowing more housing to be built.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, definitely looking forward to that one. I think this is a big question on a lot of people's minds right now, is how do we make these systems work in a way where you're actually getting people closer to, I think, you know, just like our general social and political goals as a society.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll just say, for anyone listening, if you work at a advocacy organization or for a city or county government and are interested in partnering and bringing academics on board to kind of evaluate programs that you're trying out, that's always something that us researchers are open to. And, you know, I've learned just a ton from talking to practitioners and people who are actually working in this space. Yeah, please feel free to reach out.
How can they find you?
I have a website, which is alexandersahn.com, and you can find my email there.
Okay, great. All right, last portion of this interview is always the lightning round. So okay. just a few questions for you, kind of rapid fire. First off, most underrated U.S. city?
Oh, easy. Philadelphia. I lived there a couple years ago. I was doing a postdoc just for a year. I grew up actually not that far from Philadelphia, but I'd literally never been, despite living on the East Coast for like 25 years. And yeah, it's amazing. It's like the most, I think, charming, like European, like city. It's very cheap. It's like the only affordable city on the Acela corridor, I guess, other than maybe Baltimore. And it's, yeah, very beautiful, great parks, great food scene, super kind of interesting history. Obviously, you know, you kind of like walk down the street and there's like a house that Ben Franklin like did something in 400 years ago. And, you know, I feel like you don't get that a lot in the US where everything's very new. So I would definitely recommend Philadelphia.
Yeah, no, great answer. Love Philly. Favorite international city?
Oh, that's tougher. Hard to choose, but actually, so I was just in Vancouver and I was really, really impressed. Great kind of combination of great city with a lot of natural beauty. I love that combo. So, you know, places like Vancouver, I feel like Rio also kind of hits both those marks. A lot of great cities out there. I mean, it's always fun to go explore a new place.
Yeah, I've been meaning to go to Vancouver because it's also one of the rare international cities that you can actually access by long distance Amtrak. It doesn't require getting on a flight.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it's the train there from Seattle.
Yeah, so you've got the Coast Starlight that goes from LA all the way up to Vancouver. Those are the two termini.
Okay. How long does that take?
If you were doing the entire route from LA, honestly, it would probably take a couple days. So
yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. I mean, I've done Bay Area to LA on multiple occasions, and driving is like 5.5 hours. Amtrak is 12 hours. So if you need to get there in a hurry, then it's not the best way to travel, but I love it. I vastly prefer it to driving or flying if I actually have the time to do it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love taking a train. It's just a much more comfortable way to travel. It's definitely a huge bummer that there's not more areas of the US where you can get between places doing that. And, you know, I mean, the like Portland to Vancouver corridor seems like one of the places where it would really make sense to invest a lot more in that. But
yeah,
that's topic for another 2-hour podcast.
Right, exactly. All right, next lightning round question. Best movie or TV show about housing policy?
I'm trying to think what comes to mind. There was that, I think it was called Show Me a Hero, HBO show about kind of fair housing in Yonkers a couple years ago. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I should have a good answer for movies. I teach a class on local government in the US at UNC, and I have students listen to a lot of podcasts. So actually, I have a great Twitter thread of podcasts related to local government, but I should find a good movie to add to the syllabus.
All right. Well, best podcast other than this one.
I on housing policy, I learn a ton from, I think it's the UCLA Housing Voice podcast. Yeah, they just have really interesting academics from all different types of fields who work on housing policy. And so you can learn about like public housing in France and Singapore, and also like the minutiae of like the low income housing tax credit in the US. And yeah, would recommend that for people who haven't checked it out.
Yeah, I definitely second that recommendation. I think the term of art is friend of the pod, Shane Phillips. So yeah, definitely endorse the UCLA Housing Voice podcast. All right, and the last one is I got a couple questions about the research triangle. So Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. First of all, someone's there for 24 hours. What's one place they should go, one thing they should do?
So I like to eat, and I think by far the best place to eat in the area is this place called Saltbox Seafood, just like fresh fish from the coast. Either get it grilled or fried on a plate or on a sandwich. It's really, really good, right between Durham and Chapel Hill. I always like walking around university campuses because that's my bread and butter, but UNC has a really beautiful campus. Duke's, I will say, it's not really my style. It's kind of the fake Gothic thing, but it is also very beautiful, and they have a really incredible botanical garden. Just last week I went, and all the magnolias were blooming and the cherry trees, and it's definitely spring down the south. I think I would stay in Durham, which has kind of a cool downtown. There's like a old set of tobacco warehouses that have been kind of converted into a mixed use development right next to downtown. And that's kind of a fun area just to walk around.
Great. Well, my last question was going to be about the one place to eat in that area. So I think we answered that one. Alexander Somm, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Nat. This was a lot of fun.